Greetings, film freaks. We are the Podcorn Kernels. Join us as we discuss the hard and often indigestible truths that are at the center of the fluffy and delicious world of cinema.
What's popping, people? Welcome to the Podcorn Kernels podcast. My name is Adam, and joining me in your ear holes is Harry. Say hello, Harry.
All I can say is Christian Bale's mum has a lot of explaining to do. Case in point, James Brolin.
On today's episode, we will be talking about Nightmare Alley. This is a 2021 film directed by Guillermo del Toro and stars Bradley Cooper, Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara. IMDb describes the synopsis as follows. A grifter, working his way up from low-ranking carnival worker to lauded psychic medium, matches wits with a psychiatrist bent on exposing him. Here is an original song to support the synopsis.
There's a freak over there.
Pickle baby.
Can you see it? Are you scared?
Hairy ladies.
There's a freak over there.
Pickle babies.
Can you see it? Are you scared?
Roll up, roll up. Come enjoy the show. Hold up, don't tell me what you know. Close your eyes, open your mind. I will bleed you dry, based on what I find. Exposing your secrets, finding all desires. Your money and regrets is all that I require. Spider woman, muscle man. If you're a freak, join our clan. Join our clan, join our clan, join our clan.
There's a freak over there.
Pickle babies.
Can you see it? Are you scared?
Hairy ladies. Pickle babies.
Can you see it? Are you scared?
Let's start with some facts about the film. Leonardo DiCaprio was originally picked for the lead role, with DiCaprio choosing this over projects from Paul Thomas Anderson and Alejandro G. Iñárritu. But when negotiations fell through due to not reaching a financial agreement, DiCaprio opted out and was quickly replaced by Bradley Cooper. I don't know about you, but it feels like Leo is the first option for every film.
Didn't you say the same about Richard Jewell?
Yeah, and there's been other films that his name's been floating around being the lead, and for whatever reason, he doesn't work out. Would you have liked to see Leo in the lead in this one?
I don't think it would have made much difference. I mean, it's hard. Hindsight's hard. Yeah, I mean, if they said it's all been remade and he's in it, I'd watch it just to see the contrast.
Of course, yeah.
The character, I don't think the character was intoxicating, or I don't think it warranted a huge name, to be honest.
Yeah, well,
even Bradley Cooper's quite a big name, but...
Yeah, his character in this certainly isn't groundbreaking. It's not a performance or an actor that I'm looking at thinking, oh, if they had someone more established like Leo in the lead, it would improve the film. I would watch Leonardo DiCaprio in any film. And I also happen to really like Bradley Cooper as an actor as well. But this character doesn't necessarily... It wouldn't be improved with anyone else in it because it's quite formulaic, isn't it? It's quite an interesting character, I think, but nothing that was really sort of...
No surprises.
Not really, no.
I think what you see is what you get in that film.
Yeah.
I was potentially looking for underlying, you know, twists and turns, but actually, like you said, it's very... What you see is what you get.
Yeah.
Anyone could have played the role, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. It is interesting, though, that his name seems to pop up with a lot of films as first choice. Now, I know everybody tends to like DiCaprio, and I can see why most production companies would choose him as their first pick. But has he got such a status now that you think that he's just offered every role and he just turns down every role and that's how other people get in? Because Leo says no first, then others get a sniffing of what he rejects.
Maybe. I mean, it's a star-studded cast, so maybe they just wanted a really strong frontman, vanguard, and maybe he just came to mind. Maybe his work in Shutter Island was quite reminiscent of, you know, this secret sort of, this character's got a bit of history, a bit of depth, what's going on. Maybe they looked at it like that. I thought at first it might be a bit Shutter Island.
Yeah.
When there's a part in the film where Cate Blanchett, who's a psychologist in it, isn't she? She starts to apply the same mentalist sort of techniques that Bradley Cooper's character is using. And then I thought, oh God, is it all been in his mind? And she's been a psych trying to get that out of him. I thought, what, did it Shutter Island?
Yeah.
I just totally misread the scene. It was nothing close to being that.
I'd be fascinated to see what the projects that he turned down this for. So Paul Thomas Anderson and Alejandro G. Iñárritu are both huge directors.
Is that Gravity, Iñárritu?
He did Birdman.
Birdman.
And The Revenant.
Oh,
Who did Gravity? Alfonso Cuarón.
Oh, okay.
Gravity.
Yeah.
So they are both huge filmmakers. I'd love to see what he rejected to make this, to then not go and make this one anyway.
That's the most. I think you could do a documentary on roles that people turned down or were going to get, like Tom Selleck to be Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
And stuff. It'd be so interesting to see, like. I mean, I think they mentioned once that Nick Cage was going to be Superman with a mullet.
Yeah.
I still think that was a joke and that there was no seriousness in it, but apparently deadly serious. How can Nick Cage be Superman?
He had the photo shoots and did some pre-production filming, I think, of that. And apparently Will Smith was going to be Neo, which would have been interesting.
Matrix?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, that's quite well known. He was going to... And he turned it down to do Wild Wild West.
What an idiot.
Yeah. Do you remember Wild Wild West?
It's shite.
Yeah, I don't remember anything about it. Second fact, despite being the first person in the film and in nearly every scene, Bradley Cooper doesn't speak his first word until 11 minutes and 19 seconds into the film.
I clocked that. I wrote that down.
Did you?
Yeah.
I personally think it could have been even more impactful if he went even longer.
Yeah.
Because then there would be everyone that he encounters, the intrigue would build and be like, what is this guy? Because he starts off at the film, he's a man who we know very little about. We see the opening scene, he sets fire to a home and then walks out. Then he gets on a bus, falls asleep and arrives at this carnival. And from that, we know he's trying to escape something. He's trying to start afresh, start a new life. If they prolonged the time he spoke, I think everyone that he meets would find him so more endearing. And then if when he was learning the ropes and trying to understand the people that he's encountering and stuff like that, if they made that slowly build even more, I think that could have made for a more interesting
I would character. Have liked it. Yeah, I think that would have been a really gripping artistic choice.
Mm.
And if he did speak, not very much.
Yeah.
You're right. He doesn't say anything. It's all about his look and his composure. And then for him to, when he does finally start talking, it's very, you're aware of it.
Yeah.
It's like, he shouldn't just started talking. So yeah. I pressed pause and looked, it was like 11 minutes something. You're right, I think that would have really added to the story. And maybe he's not talking because of what's come before the film.
Yeah.
So you know, obviously, that he's burning a body in a house.
But his character is someone who turns up to this environment he doesn't know and he's just trying to learn what they're all doing. And you know from the film synopsis, he's a grifter, like a con man, like he's up for making a quick buck at other people's expenses. If they'd taken even longer... And the first time he spoke was the first time he tried to pull a con on someone and everyone could see like what a natural talent he is as being a con man. I think that would have certainly made the audience feel more towards that character, because when we said Leo could be playing the lead role, there's not necessarily a lot to do with the character.
Mm.
Even though it's all based on him and his experiences, he's quite vanilla, quite black and white in what he sets out to do. So yeah, that's interesting that 11 minutes in, he hasn't said a word, and I would like to have it gone a bit longer, really.
Yeah.
Bradley Cooper claimed that many of the tabletop props in the film were actual possessions of director Guillermo del Toro. That doesn't surprise me at all.
He loves his creatures and stuff, doesn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, he's an oddball guy. And the fact that he owns all these weird little artifacts and stuff like that, I wasn't shocked to hear. I think that runs throughout his films, isn't it? The odd and the weird and the little eccentric and all those oddities certainly build up his identity as a director.
You know, Hellboy and Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah.
He loves it.
Saying that, do you remember any of the artifacts that were on the table that were his?
Talking about the babies in formaldehyde.
I'm not sure exactly.
If he keeps them in his house, he has issues.
Yeah, but you look at his body of work and you'd see, if you walked into his gaff and you saw a pickled baby, you'd be like, well, of course you have that. You're into your monsters and strange things. But it says here on the tabletop prop, so I'm assuming it might have been the tarot cards and the old school watches and all of that sort of. Yeah, all of that.
It's cool. Yeah. I mean, he put a little bit of himself in the shot. I suppose it's better than Peter Jackson putting himself as an extra in most of his Lord of the Rings films. It's cooler that there was just something that belonged to him in the shot, because that's a nice Easter egg. You wouldn't know if he hadn't said it, though.
Yeah.
Would you? So it's cool.
Jackson was in Lord of the Rings films.
Yeah, he put himself in all three of them as an extra. So is it
obvious once you know?
Yeah. I mean, in Fellowship of the Ring, he's just a gruff guy working in Bree. When they enter Bree and it's raining, he just goes, looks at them. Yeah, he just put himself in as an extra. I think that was the glory days of filmmaking, though.
Yeah.
Like, non-stop filming for 2 years, doing 3 films in New Zealand. Wow.
It'd be amazing, wouldn't it?
The only reason it's relevant to talk about it is because he put Guillermo del Toro to do the Hobbit trilogy, to direct it. But then it fell apart, didn't it? And he ended up just producing it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because they were, and I was looking forward to The Hobbit when I knew Guillermo del Toro was going to do The Hobbit.
I would 100% watch yeah. Del Toro.
He would have done. Film. He would have done the monsters and creatures justice.
Yeah, the mythical side of it, the elements yeah. of adventure and fantasy, I thought would have been really good.
But they disagreed on something. Something weren't working.
That's and a shame.
That's why Jackson ended up just doing it in the end. But
yeah, wait, Jackson did The Hobbit.
Yeah, he ended up directing it. Yeah.
I didn't know that. You're teaching me all sorts today. What did you like about the film?
It's visually striking.
Yeah.
You can't, like the lighting and the backdrop, like that. There's a scene at the start when he sets fire to the house and he's walking down the hill. You've got the sun disappearing off to the right, the darkness coming in from the left, the house is on fire. It's beautifully lit. But what really blew me away, and it's very reminiscent of Guillermo del Toro, the way he does his films, is there's this bit where Bradley Cooper's getting off the bus. And it's like the law of third. So on the left-hand side of the screen, you've got the bus and him walking off the bus, getting down the steps. And off to the right, you've got these amazing red neon lights saying cafe. And off in the background, you're seeing lightning strikes
yeah.
and thunder like rolling in. It's striking. And it blew me away, that bit. And then when he turns up to the carnival as well, there's all these extremely vibrant red neons. Really rich colors. I mean, when they break down a huge tent at the start of this film, it looks amazing. There's rain hitting the tent. There's all these guys with these trilbies on and dark faces. It looks like a comic book.
Yeah.
It looks beautiful. Really pretty. And I think that's one of the biggest things I took from it. Just that's where I think he is a master.
Yeah.
Weird choice, though. I mean, it's a remake from 1947 film. And that film was panned.
Really?
The 1947 one, yeah, it wasn't revered. It wasn't overly. People didn't obsess about it. I don't think it was revolutionary either. So it's an odd film, really. I don't understand why you'd want to go and remake a 1947 film. I think that's probably where I don't agree with maybe the project itself.
Yeah,
I feel like I like it when he does his original stuff of what I believe to be original, like Pan's Labyrinth. I don't know if that. It's just an amalgamation of fairy tales or whether it was a story before or in fact it was a remake.
It feels to me like it was a passion project of his, because if he used props from his own collection in the film and they were right at home in that environment, in that setting, it feels like it's an interest of his that he wanted to explore further.
Mm.
And if he loved the source material, it makes sense to me that he would make his own version of this.
Yeah, or he wanted to better it, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, the film is striking and you painted a beautiful picture for those that haven't seen it. The opening in particular is really beautiful, very well thought out. Do you think the aesthetic of it or the cinematography of it and how it looked, do you think it lessens as the film goes on? Or do you think the first scene was so striking that the rest of it was hard to match?
Visually, it lessens only because a third of the way through the movie, they leave the carnival setting, don't they?
Yeah.
And they go to a cold East Coast snowy city and it's very minimalism. It's during like the Art Deco times.
Mm.
Every carnival scene, I don't know if you like observed it, but there was so much depth to a shot.
Yeah.
So in the foreground, you'd have Rooney Mara and Bradley Cooper doing their scene, but you'd look 20 yards beyond that. There's carnival stuff going on 20 yards beyond that.
Mm.
And then maybe a little bit of CGI starts to creep in from the back.
Yeah.
So it's such a layered shot. And I wanted the whole thing to be set in the carnival
because
essentially that's what it was selling me. And I love carnival setting. American Horror Story Freak Show.
Yeah.
Season 3, I think, from the anthology series. It's such a playground for drama. Just like the Bronx is for a gangster film. Carnival, I mean, it allows you not only to like dip into another part of the acting world that don't get that many roles, say people with real disabilities. If you watch Freak Show, the American Horror Story one, they've got real life people with either deformities or disabilities in it, and their acting is better than your everyday actor. Really cool. I was really sad when it left the carnival scene because to me it did lost a lot of its beauty.
Yeah.
One thing I really liked about what Guillermo del Toro did, so in the carnival, when it's in like the Midwest, the plains of America, he uses these red neons which reflect off puddles and stuff. Later on in the film, he's in the city and he uses a blue neon to reflect against snow. So you see this contrast between blue and red and stuff. So it was pretty, but yeah, you can't replace the opening 30 minutes for the way it looked. If he could have kept that up throughout that whole film, it would have been visually, it's amazing.
I think when the film shifts focus from that carnival environment to the focus on being on Bradley Cooper's character, Stanton Carlisle, that's what's front and centre, is his story, his plight, his evolution as a mentalist and what he goes through. So I think it's only natural that the aesthetics of it is sort of toned down when the story focuses more on the character rather than the surroundings.
Yeah, because you have to see him progress.
Yeah.
And take his grifting to another level. Mm. And that's with the rich and famous in a big built up city, isn't it?
Yeah.
Not in some dust bowl.
That's right, yeah. What else did you like about the film?
Great ensemble cast.
Yeah.
Huge. Holt McCallany, David Strahan, Dafoe, Clifton Collins Jr., who I really like.
Yeah.
Pearlman, Collette, Rooney Mara, Blanchett, and of course, Richard Jenkins.
Yeah.
It's huge.
Massive cast. And they're all brilliant.
Yeah.
I'm a fact. The only actor in there that I'm never really sure of is Ron Perlman. But everyone else of that cast, I think, are excellent actors.
Perlman looks like he has bad breath.
Yeah, he looks like the fully evolved Pokemon version of Will Ferrell.
Yeah.
I feel that they could be siblings in...
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind seeing Will Ferrell in a film like this. But do you think with such a big cast, do you think some of them are wasted? Because like Toni Collette is one of the best and she has a very small role.
She does.
And David Strathairn.
Yeah.
He's in it as well. Excellent.
Very that is a hard role. Name, isn't it? I've always struggled
with that. Yeah, is it Strathairn?
I've loved him since Memphis Belle.
Yeah.
Since I was a kid. I've always really enjoyed his acting voice, like Good Night and Good Luck. It's brilliant. But I don't know if it's Strathairn.
Well, it's spelled Strathairn.
Strathairn.
I don't know. Strathairn. I'm sure he doesn't mind. Yeah. He knows who we're talking about him. And
yeah.
I'm
I've
sure
always struggled with the name, though. Yeah. Always hesitate when I go to say it. You know, David Strathairn. Yeah. Strathairn. He's great, man. Some films you can get away with these huge star-studded casts. Like, I think war films are a great example of huge casts. Yeah. So, Thin Red Line, Bridge Too Far, Saving Private Ryan. Well, Saving Private Ryan's got one superstar in it. Two. Matt Damon, but this is like one of his earlier roles.
Tom Hanks.
And Tom Hanks is huge. But when you look at like A Bridge Too Far or Thin Red Line, you've got like 8-9 superstar actors in them.
Mm.
And because I think they're war films, it's easier to swallow that pill that there's different levels of rank, there's different exposure to combat.
Yeah.
So you can see your Adrian Brody in Thin Red Line next to a Woody Harrelson, next to a George Clooney, next to a Caviezel. It's like, it works.
Yeah.
But I find in films like this, it can be, you almost feel bad, like they're not getting the right exposure. Like I would have liked to have seen a lot more of David Strathairn.
Yeah.
Because I found his character most fascinating because he'd been and done that all before. He'd done all the grifting. He'd said about the dangers of getting back into it. He was interesting.
Yeah. If that film was a very simple storyline of Bradley Cooper learning the ropes from David Strathairn, then that would have been an interesting film in itself.
Mm-hmm.
And the peril could have been when the sort of student tries to become the master and thinks he's better, and there could be the conflict there. But with such a big cast, I think it does a good job of not neglecting any of them because they're all fairly memorable in their roles. They all do their roles well. So I would consider that a strong point of the film, certainly.
There was only two that I disagreed the use with, and that was Holt McCallany, who's Bill Tench from Mindhunter. Yeah. It didn't do him justice playing just a bodyguard in this. It was a very small role, just to have his head caved in.
Yeah.
Spoiler, his head gets caved in. Yeah. But the worst one for me is Clifton Collins Jr., who's the bad guy protagonist in Cold Blood with Philip Seymour Hoffman. He's an excellent actor.
Oh, he's brilliant, yeah.
And he's one of the best supporting character actors. Really gritty, like I think he's brilliant. But in this film, he twangs a guitar two or three times. He has one line. You're like, really?
I think when the director's at the peak of his powers, like Guillermo del Toro is, I think that supporting cast and supporting actors are more than happy to be involved in any project of theirs, whatever the capacity.
Mm.
So because he's such a big name, it can go on their credits that they were in this film. And I believe the film was nominated for some Oscars. It was highly regarded by critics more so than the general audience. So I think when a name is synonymous with success and they've got that big reputation, I think they're more than happy to take those smaller roles.
Mm. I know Paul Walker begged for a role in Flags of Our Fathers, the Clint Eastwood movie.
Did he get it?
He did, but he literally said he'd take the tiniest role because he just wanted to be in the film.
Oh.
And Clint Eastwood was even at one point, he was just like, you know, there's just not a room for you in this film, because he was looking at Paul Walker like, you know, you're head of a huge franchise.
Yeah.
And but he got it anyway, and he plays a tiny part in Flags of Our Fathers. Just one of the lads who pulls the flag up.
Really?
But it's just how much he wanted to be in the film.
I kind of respect that.
That's cool, yeah.
If an actor looks past their past achievements and their ego and just wants to be in a film because of the love of a director or their work that they've done before, I think that's quite nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like Daniel Craig was a stormtrooper in the Star Wars film, wasn't he?
You want to do this right now?
No.
Sure?
Yeah.
Fuck but that.
That's, if you think it's nice for Paul Walker to do one bit of flag bearing in a Clint Eastwood film, why can't
but he had Daniel a face Craig... you could see him.
I but that but yeah, that extinguishes all... it immediately.
No,
yeah,
all we argued recognizable... about all we argued about was that you said
careful.
Yeah, but you said, you know, do you think it's cool that Daniel Craig like asked for a role to like put on a stormtrooper outfit, and did he have 007 on the back?
I don't know,
because they have numbers on the back, don't they? And I said,
I think that's cool.
Yeah, but I said, well, with his like privilege and the fact that he, you know, he's quite successful, I think he should have foregone that and offered it to a young kid who's got nothing and let him get in that suit.
Yeah, but so we are doing this, apparently. We are going to. So for context, we've had this conversation / disagreement / argument / debate for a while. And I sit firmly on the side of, I think it's quite sweet that Daniel Craig wanted to be involved in a Star Wars film, not necessarily take the limelight with a speaking role or play a really meaty character with loads to do. He just wanted to be in the background as a stormtrooper. Whereas Harry thinks it's almost arrogant that he thinks he can just sort of wade in and be like, I'm James Bond, let me put on a stormtrooper.
No, you outfit. Said to me, would I do it? And I said, I wouldn't. No, I wouldn't be like, oh, put me in a suit and put me in that film. Because I'm James Bond. It's always been a dream of mine to be on the set of a Star Wars movie.
So you're an actor.
Yeah.
You're a well-established actor.
People I've already made it.
They love you.
Yeah.
Uncle Quentin is making a new film and you want a role in his film. And he's like, oh no, there's not really a role for you. And you're like, well, can I be? I see that there's a ragtag group of like alcoholics outside one of the buildings. Can I be one of them? You won't even know it's me. You can put a huge beard and a huge hat on.
But that's not the argument. The argument was you said, yes, I would. And I said, no, I wouldn't. I said, if I'd already made it and I was as famous as James Bond, I wouldn't beg, request, or ask to be in a stormtrooper outfit and be on the set of Star Wars.
But my argument...
I've already made it.
My argument back to you is I think that you're wrong in what your opinion is of this. I think that you would.
Yeah, but I also said I'd sleep with Ian McKellen to get a role. And you disagree with that.
Okay. We'll leave it there then. And maybe we'll have a dedicated episode and of the year-long arguments we've had about films throughout our friendship. What else did you like about the film?
That's all I got.
Okay. My favourite thing about the film was the mentalist mentality. So I'm fascinated by everything to do with that world of illusions and trickery. So I love the journey of like mind manipulation in this one. The film does a great job in showing how the people that want to believe are the easiest to trick and target.
Yeah.
Now, I'm a huge fan of like Derren Brown films like The Prestige and Illusionist. I love that idea that with confidence and intelligence, you can almost manipulate people, whether it's for financial gain or to secure a better job. If you are a confidence person or a con man, you use that as a strength and can sort of utilize that to get what you want. And I think the film does a very good job in showing that and the sort of how morally wrong it is to do that.
Well, it shows you the consequences in the film, doesn't it?
Exactly. So, and you weigh that up. I think I've got a point about the consequence later on in what I want to say, but you weigh that up. It's whether or not the risk is worth the reward. And I think the film treads that line really well. It's like you're really manipulating people that are grieving here who want to speak to a lost relative, or you're willing to scam people out of money so they can hear what they want to hear for closure. And I think it's a really interesting perspective. The film questions its audience, like, is it acceptable if no one's getting hurt? And it, on one hand, you can look at it and be like, well, if the people are hearing what they want to hear, they're paying for a service and they're benefiting from it. But on the other side, if it's all bullshit and it's all lies, it can be really damaging. So I like that, that insight into that world. personally, for me, it really worked.
I also liked it was the psychologist versus performer aspect of the film. So
Blanchett's character.
Yeah, Kate Blanchett and Bradley Cooper go toe-to-toe in this one, and both are guilty of using their intelligence to exploit. I found it really interesting how one is regarded as an important member of society while the other one is villainized. Both are feeding on people's insecurities and making a profit from it.
He says, look, you're in the same racket as me, essentially, well, isn't he?
They are. They, you know, people are looking for help and looking for reassurance, and they're willing to give it to them for a price. So that, and based on my first like with the mentalist aspect of it, I think all of that as a package, it just really works. The explorations it takes. And yeah, just worked for me.
It's cool. It's like it's act two, essentially, is it, with Kate Blanchett and the moving away from the carnival. I had a question to ask. So, you know, obviously, you think these two are having a love affair. You think she's helping him con rich guys by pretending to talk to the dead. When she turns on him in the film, shoots him, blows his ear off, and literally turns, she essentially becomes the Dark Galadriel from Lord of the Rings. Why is she only doing that? Because it's personal, isn't it? It's because he called her out at a seance and hit her and said, your mother, you have regrets, and her head dropped. She's literally just doing it to do that, get revenge.
So, for context, when Bradley Cooper's character, Stanton Carlisle, is established as a mentalist, he goes to do these bigger circuits. He says to the audience that he can like read their minds or speak to dead people. And he does this based on the support from his girlfriend,
Rooney Mara.
Yeah, Molly Cahill, played by Rooney Mara. And Kate Blanchett's there basically to belittle him, to say you're talking shit. And what Bradley Cooper does, his deduction, he manages to establish what Kate Blanchett has in her bag. So she's trying to say to everyone, look, he's a fraud. But he manages to belittle her and get it right. So her back's up because of that. So then the rest of the film is her showing that she's a superior intelligence, and she's doing exactly to him what he's doing to everyone else.
She's playing the long game, isn't she?
She's playing the long game, manipulating him, getting him onto the alcohol, like acting like they were having this really heartfelt affair, when all the time she's just playing him at his own game. Taste of his own medicine.
He sniffed her tummy scar.
He did sniff her tummy scar.
Was it a chest? It was a chest tummy scar. And
a chest tummy scar.
Chest tummy scar. And here comes my second question.
Oh, there's more.
Is it implied in the film that Richard Jenkins' character, the big, crazy, rich guy, did he cut her up? I don't know, because she sort of talks about, don't mess with this man, regret and stuff, he's violent, he's dangerous. Then she reveals this scar sort of puts a C around her breast, and I was just like, did he do it?
Maybe. I saw it as maybe a clever metaphor, that for a character who's so cold and heartless, she's had a heart operation, which suggests that she's obviously got a heart.
Oh, that's
but
cool.
Yeah, I saw it as that metaphor. That's how I saw it personally. But it would make complete sense that Richard Jenkins' character, Ezra Grindle, in the film, basically reveals he's a female serial killer.
Yeah.
Well, he kills women. He's not a female.
Yeah. Trying to find answers to us, because he forced a miscarriage of his girlfriend at the time.
And he reveals, through trying to hire Stanton Carlisle, played by Bradley Cooper, through hiring him to be able to speak to the dead, that Bradley Cooper's character realizes that he's a bad man that's done bad things to women. So it would make perfect sense that Kate Blanchett was an almost victim to that. Yeah, I could see that.
Maybe, yeah. I could have read it wrong. I just got that impression.
The final thing I liked about it was the villain-to-victim narrative. I found Stanton Carlisle's arc really intriguing. Bradley Cooper's character sets out for a fresh start, and he goes from being an enthusiastic outsider to someone who uses what he's learned from the kindness of strangers to gain money and stardom. Then greed takes over and he ends up suffering as a result. So those three points that I liked about the film, they all sort of blend into one another to make, for me, a really interesting concept. And I really liked the blurred lines between right and wrong, between greed and corruption, and how it all comes sort of full circle. And he ends up, you know, becoming a victim.
A geek.
Yeah, pretty much.
That was questionable, wasn't it? Oh, so in the film, Willem Dafoe's character, who's one of the carnies, he has a process and a little monologue about how he gets a geek. And in the film, a geek essentially is someone who's so down on their luck, has an addiction or something. And it breaks them down to a point where they're so craving alcohol or opium that they'll eat a live chicken.
Yeah.
And he calls him a geek. But they're essentially caged. They're essentially slaves. How the hell is that not being found out by the police or the sheriffs?
Well,
Why has no one walked away from that and gone, a police? I think someone's being abused.
I think the film sort of takes some sort of
artistic license
in that sense. And the folks of the carnival world and that community are so shut off that for the most part, I think they're left to it. You see one scene in the film that the sort of authorities come and try and see if anything untoward's happening, and they're all really quick to be able to cover it up. And in the film, Stanton Carlisle sort of brings the investigating officer on side by using his
newfound talent
skills, as a mentalist to sort of deter him. The authorities just tended to leave them be because they didn't want to fuck with that business, basically.
It would have been weird, wouldn't it, in them times?
Yeah.
So I know that whole carnival thing was big up until 1940s. And then morals started to kick in and laws against, you know, exhibiting people with disabilities and stuff. So it's kind of cool to think that in the 40s, I think apartheid even existed in South Africa up until the 70s or 60s. It's but mad. In the 40s in America, they were already looking at it like, this is wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is icky.
Well, it's a zoo.
Yeah.
For humans.
Yeah.
It's weird, but it's fascinating.
Yeah, you can't look away, can you?
Pillow man, elephant man.
Yeah.
Just throw man at the end, it'll work.
Yeah, yeah. It's brilliant. What didn't you like about the film?
Plot was too predictable for me.
Go on.
I could just see every step as it came. Like, I didn't want it to be that way. I was kind of hoping there would be a wicked reveal or a twist in the end where I get it, but I think I called it about an hour in, like, this guy's going to become a geek. You're going to see his rise and fall.
Yeah.
There was nothing, like, surprising about it. It was a very vanilla story and too long.
Yeah.
Way too long to get across the point it was making. You could have easily done that film effectively within an hour and 35 or 40. Like, I think it's like 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
And I felt like the minute it left the carnival, it should have either got more... I mean, obviously, you do get your violence a bit later, don't you? You see Jenkins die, McCauley die, quite dirt ways.
Yeah.
Getting your nose punched off and stuff. And he gets his ears shot off, Stan. Stan?
Stanton.
Stanton.
So, yeah, Stan. His mates call him Stan.
So you see a bit of gore, but it never came as a surprise. I mean, I was waning. My interest was waning.
Yeah.
From such an exotic opening and such a, like, a beautifully made film in the beginning, it just started, for me, I started to get bored.
Yeah.
About an hour in, started to get a bit bored and just, don't know, felt the plot was very vanilla, guessed where it was going. I don't know, I didn't really care about him either, the protagonist.
No. I must admit, I did call the quote-unquote twist fairly early on as well. Would you like to explain the twist just for context?
Yeah, so early on in the film, there's a bit of foreshadowing. So Willem Dafoe's character, whilst explaining to Bradley Cooper the ropes of carnies and small hands smell like cabbage, he explains, how'd you break in a geek? And Willem Dafoe just tells him about it. And he says, essentially what I do is I grab a drifter or someone who's down on their luck and I say, you know, I might have some work for you, but it's only temporary. He gives this little monologue. And essentially, you see Bradley Cooper's rise and fall through greed. He ends up doing his tricks and stuff in high society. And he's earning enough. I mean, he's living in a lush room. He's earning enough. Don't know why he feels the need. His character's that greedy to the point where he needs to chase down billionaire socialites.
Because it's never enough. I think that's the point of the story.
It's never enough until he has regret.
Yeah.
Which comes very quickly as soon as he... So everyone in the film's telling him, everyone, don't do this. Don't do this. Even Colette comes back on the scene a couple of years after he's left the carnival. Don't do it. You know, everyone's telling him. So it's like, well, the film's clearly going to do it. He's going to do it. And anyway, you see his downfall. He never touches alcohol. But Kate Blanchett, using the manipulation that you were talking about, gives him the one poison that he's avoided all his life because of his dad. Predictable again. You know, I was quite positive that the body he drags in the hole at the very start of the film was either his dad or mum. Positive of it. And then you get little clippets of him caring for an old man. And then towards the end of the film, takes the covers off, lets the guy freeze to death, and it's his dad. He hates him. But anyway, he ends up, becomes homeless, becomes a drifter, ends up at another carnival. And the guy says, go away, you smell of piss. And then he stops him, goes, sit down, have a drink. I'm sorry. One carny to another. He goes, I might have a job for you.
Yeah.
But it's temporary. So it tells you, look, he's going to become a geek. He's going to be sitting in a cage, ripping chicken heads off and stuff. And it's just kind of like, I mean, I've already had this. I had this at the start. And David Strahan is essentially Bradley Cooper down the line as well. So because David Strahan tries to warn him that the powers of these books, of this book that gives you the power of manipulation, can get to your head and you start to believe you can talk to the dead. So it's very predictable. It tells you early on in the film everything that's going to happen.
I think that
if you watch for foreshadowing, you'll know the end.
Yeah, I think someone who's just a sort of mid-tier film fan would have seen enough films to notice that that's where the film's going. And I think the biggest problem is as soon as you see that, you're waiting for the inevitable. You're waiting for Cooper to turn into a geek. And if that's in your head fairly early in the film, you're then asked to sit through almost 2 hours knowing the outcome. And I think once you know that, it is hard to look past that. So I do agree with you in that sense, I think.
Mm-hmm.
What else didn't you like about the film?
Well, I covered quite a few there, essentially. I wanted it to stay in the carnival. I found the plot predictable. He ignores all the warning signs. The last one, his plan to materialize Richard Jenkins' dead lover who had a miscarriage by dressing up Rooney Mara in old clothes and covering her in ketchup.
Yeah.
I thought that was the worst plan on earth. And it would have worked if it would have just been a glance of her walking past the bush, walking past the fountain, getting away. The plan was like, I'll hold him down while you stand there. Bradley Cooper's attempt to stop the man from getting close to Rooney Mara was pathetic.
Yeah.
And within seconds, he gets to Rooney Mara and holds her and goes, "You're not her."
Yeah.
And then it's just like, for a really intelligent guy, it was a very poorly thought out plan.
Yeah.
I think I just got annoyed at his organisational skills.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
That's it.
And the film takes so long to get to that point and it's wrapped up all quickly. Like the walls come tumbling down around Stanton Carlisle, Bradley Cooper's character, so quickly. It's like, well, this was inevitable. I've waited this long. Mm. And that when there wasn't any sort of curveballs or fascinating twists, it did play out. And I thoroughly enjoy the film, but I do think that is a glaring problem with it, is that the predictability, the fact that it asks you to sit around and be captivated for so long, and then the payoff really isn't that surprising.
Well, it's kind of like you don't want him to succeed.
Yeah.
You know, he's not lovable. You see Rooney Mara's character not enjoying her time in high society and doing the job anymore. She doesn't want to trick people or hurt their feelings. So it's just such an obvious, they're going to split. He doesn't know what he's losing. I think I've just, over the years, I get more into my layered, depthy things. I like my grey characters.
Yeah.
Whereas to me, he was very dark and very greedy. It's hard to just watch someone who's greedy.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
It sounds like you were willing for the film to be more. You were willing for a fast right turn or something that sort of shook things up. And because it didn't happen, it left you feeling a little bit,
I thought something supernatural was going to happen.
That would have been cool.
Given Guillermo del Toro's background, I thought the idea was they're blinded by greed. And then in being a charlatan, they are then shook by a real event.
Yeah.
And I thought potentially, see a ghost or someone actually touches Bradley Cooper on the shoulder.
Yeah. You play with fire, you're going to get burnt.
Yeah. And all of a sudden this guy who's confident and charming and good looking, all of a sudden he's terrified, scared because he's seen a ghost and then becomes a geek.
Yeah. That would have been cool. That would have been cool.
It would have been better and I would have done a better job.
Okay. I'd watch your version, mate.
Cheers, dude.
Yeah.
Cheers. I'll do it on iPhone.
Yeah.
I'll get three old mates used to do college acting with me. Get some beers.
Yeah.
Get some barbecue going.
You'd have to ask Leonardo DiCaprio if he wanted the role first.
Oh, Lee DiCap, come on down.
Yeah. The elements that didn't work for me, the main one aligns with yours, really, and that's the runtime. Whilst I enjoyed the film, 2.5 hours did feel a little bloated, with some parts dragging on a little longer than necessary. So completely what you said. I completely agree with those sentiments. Another thing I didn't like about the film, and this is more of a personal outlook, is it made me want to drink alcohol and smoke.
Always.
I'm trying to stop smoking and drink less, but the constant smoking and drinking throughout made me really want to sip whiskey and toke some smokes.
Toke some smokes.
It did. It did. And I was watching that film and you speak about the aesthetics and the carnival setting and like even the simple parts when he's come from a long day of being a mentalist and he just kicks back and he has a whiskey and a smoke and I was just sitting there going, oh, I'd like to have a whiskey and a smoke.
So, yeah, it made me, almost made me go and buy cigarettes and drink some whiskey, but I didn't.
If you're ever trying to quit, there's no point watching stuff like Deadwood or True Detective.
Mad Men.
You're going to be, Mad Men. You're just going to want a daiquiri, some King Prawns and a shit load of smokes.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's just a personal dislike for me. And my final dislike is another personal one, Spider Lady.
I knew you were going to say that.
Spider Lady.
Called it.
Blink and you'll miss her, but there's a woman with a human head and body of a big spider.
Well, no, the spider part's a costume. She's tucked her head into...
but the legs are moving, and it looked big spider.
Yeah, it looked like animatronic, didn't it?
Yeah, but I don't like big spider, even pretend big spider. Though.
Pretty face.
For a spider.
For a spider body woman thing.
Yeah. But I know it's pathetic. I just don't like it. And one of my objectives in this podcast is to warn fellow arachnophobes when there are spiders on screen.
And one of my objectives is to get you to watch Arachnophobia, Eight-Legged Freaks.
Well, if I do that, I will have to drink and smoke just to get me through it.
I could deal with that combo,
I fear that.
I could deal with that.
I couldn't even watch the second Harry Potter film because of the big fuck-off spiders. Nope.
That's Lord of the creepy.
Rings. Lord of the Rings, when the big spider boys get involved. Nope.
Shelob.
Hobbit, there's like a whole film where there's an army of the big bastards. Nope, don't want it. Don't want it. Mm-hmm. Nope. I'm scared even thinking about it, so I'll move on to the questions if you're interested.
Ready when you are, Sergeant Pembry.
Nightmare Alley boasts an impressive cast. Who delivered the best performance and why? I think I know your answer.
Ding, ding, ding. David Strahan.
I knew your answer.
Because he's been there. He's been there and done it in real life and his character.
Yeah.
And he's...
He acts as a warning sign to Bradley Cooper's character, doesn't he?
He does. He's succumbed to his tricks of the trade. I think he feels guilty because he even mentions a bit of back history between him and Toni Collette about when we stayed in the Ritz in Paris. So it's all foreshadowing. Toni Collette and David Strahan's character is the same as Rooney Mara and Cooper's years later.
Mm.
They stayed in the Ritz in Paris because they were doing the entertainment, end up in a carnival because he's an alcoholic. But yeah, he was my... Probably he's the most fascinating character.
Killed off. Spoiler alert.
Killed off. Don't know whether intentional or by accident.
What do you reckon? So in the film,
Bradley Cooper's reaction to him collapsing and being told something's happened, he looked so shocked.
Yeah.
But, so that would imply to me that he did it by accident.
But then he also establishes himself as someone not to be trusted and will do whatever he needs to do for his own personal gain.
If that's the case, I question Guillermo del Toro's choice to show you him surprised by the fact that Strahan has died.
But that's
misleading.
That's the performative side of his character. So he's like, oh, what? Oh, he died. Oh, shocked. So should we give that a bit of context, that scene?
Yeah.
So David Strathern plays Pete, who is like the daddy mentalist. He's like, well, Bradley Cooper's character, Stanton Carlisle, effectively is his protege. And Pete teaches Stanton all the tricks of the trade on how to become a mentalist, what signals you have to look out for, the reads you need to pick up on and all of that sort of stuff. And in the film, he's an alcoholic and asks Bradley Cooper to go and get him some alcohol.
Sugar cane.
So where the alcohol is situated, there's two types of alcohol from what I understand. One's the good alcohol, the other one's basically poison.
One's used to preserve pickle babies.
Yeah.
So formaldehyde, well, a way to preserve dead pickle baby.
Pickle baby.
And the other one is just alcohol.
Yeah.
Whatever fuckwit supply chain logistics guy decided to put them right next to each other and go, that one's deadly and whatnot. I mean, it's just... Why take the chance?
Yeah. And so what we're debating is whether or not Stanton Carlisle chose the poisoned alcohol.
To supplant Strahan, steal his book.
Yeah. I think he did because he's a shifty guy and that's a shifty guy move.
I think it's an accident because his reaction and the speed into which he ran to the scene of the crime told me that it was an accident.
Maybe it was subconsciously deliberate.
Then Guillermo del Toro shouldn't have shown us his reaction. He should, when everyone else is running over to Strahan, Cooper should have stayed sitting down because he knew exactly what he was going to see when he got there.
Mm. Well, I look forward to your version to see how you handle that part of the film.
So simps, man.
The film is an intriguing exploration into there being consequences to our actions. Do you believe that what goes around comes around, or do you see the concept of karma as mere coincidence that just helps us justify things?
Hogwash.
Karma, no.
There is no karma. There is no what comes around goes around.
Karma, no to you.
Bad people can get away with bad shit all their life and die a happy death. And it can happen another way. Bad people can get their comeuppance.
Okay.
There is no rule.
I was just interested to see your thoughts on karma.
I do not believe in it.
I know.
I tell you what I do believe in, though. Instant Karma's gonna get you. The song. I like the song.
Oh, okay. But
John
Lennon. Not the concept. Because
we all fall down.
Do you like the Karma song?
I love the song.
What about Karma, 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 Chameleon?
I like there's a stripped down version that a Boy George a tribute act do. It's a stripped down version. It's really cool.
So Karma in theory, no. Karma in song, yes, please.
Karma Chameleon in song, yes. Karma in theory, no. Karma, Instant Karma, yes, song.
But Instant Karma, no, in real life.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Final question. Do you think people's obsession with reality television is just an extension of humanity's curiosity to watch others that differ from them, and the modern day fascination with celebrity is just an evolution of when society would pay to go to see extraordinary individuals in the name of entertainment?
Have you found a correlation between Big Brother and freak shows?
Well, yeah, kind of. Because back in the day, people would go to pay and see these extraordinary people that were different from themselves. And as we've evolved, we now watch sexy singles slutting it up on Love Island. Mm-hmm. Or before Jeremy Kyle got cancelled, we'd go and see...
They're the real freaks.
We'd watch.
For but me, that, they're the real freaks.
So that's my question. Do you think that this is... So you could even argue it started in the gladiatorial arena where mm-hmm. you just watch people fight for your entertainment.
But that and was prowess, wasn't it? That was their talent.
But then it's evolved. So my question stripped back is, do you think this was the founding fathers of reality television?
Basically. Yeah, there's a type of ghoulishness to it, isn't there? Like the observing it. For your own kicks or for how different someone can be from you. But no, but the problem with the likes of Love Island and stuff is it's...
shite.
It's awful, but it's observing their physique, their breasts, their six packs, their tan. Like, you can't be pale and go into Love Island.
No.
Because it's...
Or intelligent, apparently.
The two brain cell gym freaks and the... What? You what? Them birds. They're it's like watching animals.
But that's the point. So
no, but they don't... Yeah, but they're not physically stunted, are they? They're mentally stunted, hence why there's a lot of suicides with...
Big claim.
With reality shows and stuff, because there's this weird benchmark that's been set about being, like, perfect, keeping your pecs and stuff, and being that perfect. It's okay to come across as a thick piece of shit, but as long as you look good,
yeah,
that's all they've got. Whereas, like, with a freak show, you're looking at abnormalities and things against the grain. So you look at the Elephant Man, everyone was fascinated to look at him, but if I actually just spoke to him...
He's a normal dude.
I'm a human being!
Yeah.
Essentially. Yeah. Stolen, Will Ferrell, deleted scenes, Anchorman 2.
Knowledge.
Yeah.
Okay,
You're right. There is a correlation, I would say, because from an audience point of view, you are literally watching animals. Love Island.
Yeah.
Not the freak show.
Yeah. I'm glad you cleared that up. So what would you rate Nightmare Alley out of 10?
6.5.
6.5?
6.5, yeah. You can't deny how visually stunning it is. I don't know. COVID might... The COVID stop during filming. I think they had to stop filming in March. They had to stop and come back to it. I don't know if that affected its flow or its runtime, but yeah, 6.5. There are good takeaways from this film. If you love visual effects and you love cinematography, it's worth a watch.
Yeah. And if you've got an interest in that sort of mentalism, mind manipulation,
alienism, alienist.
Yeah. All of that sort of spiel, then you'll probably have a good time. I do love that. I find that stuff fascinating, even if it is just manipulating people and reading people based on what they wear or how they hold themselves. I find that really, really fascinating.
Yeah.
So for me, it was a big win.
I can get that from The Prestige, and I can get it a lot quicker and a lot more tasty.
Yeah.
I don't need as much seasoning. I felt like I needed to bring my own salt and pepper shaker along to watch this film.
See, when the food in question is this sort of food... I can have it seasoned, unseasoned, in gluten-free bread, or on its own.
Like, you're already losing, though, aren't you, with gluten-free bread?
Yeah.
You're essentially going in knowing full well this film could taste better.
Yeah, but I can't digest.
You can't digest it, yeah.
I can't digest gluten.
Yeah.
Overshare. So that, yeah, I'd rate it 8 out of 10.
Nice.
I loved it. It's the second time I watched it, and I agree.
5 hours you've watched.
I've spent 5 hours of my life watching that film.
Did you do it in a black and white?
No, they did. I couldn't find that version on Disney Plus.
I wanted to watch it in black and white, yeah. But then I realised, this is prior, sorry, prior to that, I wanted to watch it in black and white. When I saw it and the colour and the neon lighting, I knew I didn't.
Yeah.
I was like, oh no, don't need it.
I'd happily watch it a third time in black and white. As I say, it's the second time I've seen it. I enjoyed it more the second time round, even though the sort of the story itself is play by play without any huge twists. I still really enjoyed my time.
Noir.
So yeah, 8 out of 10 for me. That gives Nightmare Alley a total score of 14.5 out of 20, which is decent.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
I think so.
If you like your fantasy films, if you like people fucking people over with mind magic and all that sort of sugar.
Tummy chest sniff.
Yeah.
Pickle baby,
tummy chest sniff.
Hairy woman.
Hairy woman, spider lady, leg lady.
Ron Perlman. Smelly breath Perlman.
Yeah, if you like any of those things, you'll probably like this one. Consider watching Nightmare Alley if you enjoyed The Prestige, The Illusionist, and The Shape of Water. Should we play a game?
Si, senor.
The game in question is What the Plot, where the rules are simple and the results quite the opposite. Harry will conceive an original idea from his big and beautiful brain and give birth to a plot. It is then down to me to nurture this thought by providing a film title, genre, cast, and anything else I can think of to raise this brainchild into a fully functioning film concept. Over to you, Harry.
I want to go a little bit against the grain today. Ooh. I want it to be based on a true story, this one. Because I was reading a little news article last night about a interesting moment in history. 1972. Okay. JAT Yugoslav Airlines Flight 367.
Hold up. Say that again.
No, you don't need to write it down.
Oh, okay. Continue.
JAT Yugoslav Airline Flight 367. Okay. So it's a Yugoslavian airline, 367. It blows up midair. It's a true story. Happened in 1972, 26th January. 46 minutes into its flight after takeoff, it blew up in midair. A woman on that plane called Vesna Vulevich. Okay. She lived. She fell 33,000 feet.
No.
And lived.
No.
Yeah, she got pinned down by a food cart in the back of the fuselage. She holds the Guinness World Record for the longest free fall without a parachute. And she survived this crash. And I was thinking, for a film, that's the opening. You know, and even more, it's all there. Everything you need for a film is already in this true story. She weren't supposed to be on the plane. She was a stewardess, and she had a similar last name to another stewardess, so she got tasked to this plane. She wasn't even supposed to be on it, which is so insane when you think about it, when people talk about miracles and God and stuff.
Or karma.
Or instant karma chameleons. And she lived, so I thought, well, if the opening 20 minutes of the film, kind of like Flight, is the shock, the tragedy, like, imagine the fear you could film. With her being at the back, moving a food trolley, and then boom. It was a terrorist attack, by the way. A Croatian nationalist blew up the Yugoslav plane because they wanted separation from Yugoslavia. And I think she was about 30 or something. She had blonde hair. I sent you a photo. That's why I said to you, research his face.
Yeah.
Just in case.
Pay more attention to that message.
But imagine the film starts with that. The explosion, the fear, the terror.
How did she survive?
She was pinned to a cart, so she was kept with the plane, whereas everyone else tends to bounce around and obviously die on impact, die from exposure. She got locked and sort of held in place, and just it's just one of those freak anomalies where it manages. She just survived, and basically a farmer came by who was a medic in the war, in one of the wars, World War II maybe, and he manages to keep her alive. Because she was just screaming, and she had a turquoise blue outfit on. And he found her, kept her alive until the ambulance got to her. But yeah, Guinness World Records, highest free fall ever without a parachute. True story. Weren't supposed to be on the plane. And I was reading it, I just thought, this would be a great film.
So did she end up being plane wrecked somewhere? Or did she land in the ocean?
East Germany? No, it was just East Germany. It was hit the ground.
So and she was found immediately?
Well, the guy happened upon her, so he'd be a huge character because he essentially applied first aid, kept her alive. Everyone else died. Everyone. Through the free fall, freezing, trauma. But she lived. The chances of it happening, I mean, it's never happened. It's so rare. She fell 33,000 feet. It's like 2 minute freefall, constant, with all that noise and stuff. Just imagine how shocking it would have been. But then the film is her getting over it. It's
I imagine she'd be in the public eye, so people would want to be talking to her, and how she deals with the sort of general public's fascination with how she survived and stuff.
Yeah.
So only a small part of the film, like you say, the start would be the crash.
I think that, what an opening to a film. Yeah. It's like that opening episode of Lost. It's brilliant because it's so raw. It's like, whoa, what's happened? But how, I mean, my spiders are plane crashes.
Yeah.
I hate flying. I've flown all over the world, but I hate flying.
Would you want to watch this film with that fear?
I haven't flown for 4 years, so I'd watch it now.
Yeah. Not if you had a flight
coming. If I had a flight coming, I couldn't watch it.
Yeah.
It just wrecks me. That the problem with a plane crash is you can't fight or flight. You're not grounded. You can't run away. You can't do anything. You're done. Especially at 33,000 feet.
How the fuck did she survive that, though?
Read about it, man. It's amazing. Vesna Vulevich.
Okay.
26th of January, 1972.
So, in summary, and you can fill in the gaps here because I didn't write a lot down because too many words.
Yeah, but it was a true story. So,
it's based on a true story from 1972 where an airline flight blows up midair.
Mm-hmm. Terrorist attack.
A terrorist attack. A woman called Vesna Vulevich.
Yeah, Vulevich.
Manages to survive even after being in an exploding
old Guinness World
plane
Record.
For 30,000 feet.
Yep.
She survived because she was trapped by a food cart.
Yeah.
She wasn't even supposed to be on the plane.
No.
No.
They got the name wrong, but put her on that plane as an attendant. She shouldn't have been on it.
So, and the film starts with the crash, and she ends up surviving this huge ordeal by being pinned to a food cart. Then the film turns, and it's about her dealing with the trauma of that, because fucking hell, that would be traumatic, yeah, wouldn't it? And then dealing with the aftermath of all of that.
She still died young, quite young. Not for it might have been from the trauma. Event, but years later,
yeah,
like about maybe 20 years after that, it actually
that
happened.
That would change you.
I'd go white overnight, my hair. If I had hair, I would just go, you know, when they talk about shock,
yeah,
and what it can turn people's hair white overnight. Like, it's just the fact that she didn't even have a heart attack or shock or have all the air pulled from her lungs. It's insane.
It's madness.
Yeah.
The odds of surviving that. I'll look that up. That sounds fascinating.
You kind of want it to not be true, don't you? You think she was a farmer. She quickly ran into the wreckage, put on some clothes and laid down and went, yes, lottery ticket.
That would also be a very interesting film if that happened.
Let's change it.
No, we've gone too far. I like the true story angle.
Yeah, based on a true story.
Yeah.
That always grips me. If I see that at the start of a film, love it. Love it.
So I'd see this as a straight up drama film.
Yeah.
I'd have, as director, I would have a director who's known for their sort of depiction of true stories and real events. Considering that the main character is a female, I'd also have a female director. And I'd have Kathryn Bigelow directing this one.
He shoots, he scores.
Yeah, she's a fantastic director that done Hurt Locker.
Zero Dark.
Detroit. I think she did Zero Dark 30 as well. So really established, gritty, true story director that's proved her worth in many times before. And in the lead, it would have been easy for me. I vaguely remember the picture you sent, a blonde, attractive young woman. I could have gone Scarlett Johansson. I could have gone Jennifer Lawrence. But I think for a film where it needs to be more grounded and a bit more of a layered performance with a more established actor, I'd say I'd go for Charlize Theron.
Yeah.
In the lead. She's a little bit older, but she's a great looking woman, a fantastic actor. And I watched her performance in Monster
recently,
the 2003 film by Patty Jenkins recently, and she was phenomenal. So she's proved her worth in my eyes in terms of portraying a real person.
I thought her as well. When I looked at the photo of the real girl, because of obviously how she pulled off Monster and also had a prosthetics applied, but also how she acted the age, I thought she could easily do this sort of Russian woman.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think so.
I think she's Russian. Just basing it on the name.
Yugoslavia. Well, that was the
Vesna Vulevich.
That was the plane.
The airline is Jet Yugoslav Airlines.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, Kathryn Bigelow starring Charlize Theron. And I've got a toss-up between two titles.
Ooh.
One being Fight or Flight, and the other being Wings of Fate.
I prefer Wings of Fate.
I do too.
Wings of Fate's a good one.
Yeah, Wings of Fate, directed by Kathryn Bigelow and starring Charlize Theron.
From Oscar-winning director Kathryn Bigelow. And starring Oscar winner Charlize Theron. See the phenomenal true story critics are calling a tour de force of survival against all odds. Wings of Fate, coming soon.